This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Michelle Aloy, in for Madeline Brand. Los Angeles is one of the world's premier food cities, a city famous for holding its fanciest restaurants run by some of the most famous chefs in equal regard to the street-side taco stand. The roots of that culture can be traced back more than a century and are still visible today if you know where to look. The city's culinary history is explored in a new book by Chef George Geary. It's called LA's Landmark Restaurants, celebrating the legendary locations where Angelenos have dined for generations. And George Geary joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, let's get into a little bit of the history. Early in the book, you feature two of LA's longest running establishments with a legendary historic conflict. Both opened in 1908. Both claim to have invented the French dip. So tell us about the origin story of the French dip. Was it invented by Coles or Philippe's?
Well, I feel they both can scream about it and fight about it. If you go to Coles today, it's a bar, and you've got a few little things you can buy. One is a French dip sandwich. Philippe's, a lot of French dip sandwiches go out of there. They always had the word French in their title somewhere. Coles originally was a place where commuters went in and out through the red car line, the train station, in the 1900s, and it was a buffet. And so I'm looking at it as they saw that the sandwiches were very popular across the street, so they started making them, and then they said that they were the founder. But all the early paperwork, and I even have the first places Philippe's was, they always had the word French in it. There was something about French-dipped sandwiches. And so that's why I put them as the curator.
And for the uninitiated, describe what a French-dip sandwich is.
The roll is kind of a hard roll that they dip in the juice or the au jus, and it's just meat. They don't have anything else on it but the meat and the sandwich bread. You might put a little bit of mustard. They make hot mustard to where they put it on the table there at Philippe's, and if you smell it, it opens your sinuses like crazy very quickly. So if you have a cold or anything, you can be sure.
And you have the recipe in the book. What goes into it?
I have a few recipes, not the sandwich recipe.
But the mustard recipe.
Yeah, the mustard recipe. And it's just a mustard. And they didn't give me the recipe to it, so I had to create my own on that one. There are some restaurants that gave me their recipes, actually, but I would have to recreate them. And one restaurant gave me 14 pounds of avocados for their guacamole, so I had to do it myself.
Okay. And did the clientele, the community for these two restaurants, did they differ in any meaningful way?
The commuter was going through Coles, pretty much. And the people building Los Angeles, because originally the first Philippe's was close to where the City Hall was built. So it was on that street. And they were building buildings there. So you had the blue-collar worker, and then the commuters were at the other one. And they were across town from each other. And they still are.
Well, and in terms, I mean, these places have both been around for more than a century, but their menus, I mean, they've changed, but not meaningfully so. They still hold true to the restaurants that they were when they opened. So is that part of their staying power?
I think so. And the nostalgia, both places are great places to go. Coles has a great bar scene, and they even have a speakeasy in the back that they didn't have years back. So, yeah.
From the Prohibition era?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Some of the landmarks featured in your book are, unfortunately, COVID casualties, though, and one of the iconic ones was the Pacific Dining Car. So tell us a little bit about, for the people who never got the chance to go there, the food they served and the kind of ambiance they curated there.
Yeah, there was one in Santa Monica also. That one closed first. They almost hit 100 years, only 99 years, and it was a family place that family owned. And it was a dining car, actually, that was off to the side, and that's what they started serving in. Kind of like the Formosa Cafe in West Hollywood is a dining car on one side. They'd take old dining cars and throw them off to the side, and that would be their dining room. So the Pacific Dining Car, I was there about 2 months before they closed, and I didn't realize they were going to close, and they keep saying they aren't closed. They say, we're going to reopen. But you drive by and everything's gone and they auctioned everything off. So I don't think they're going to, in my eyes, they aren't reopening.
And when the original location opened, what was the scene? What sort of food did they specialize in?
It was open 24 hours. So they had five menus during the day. They'd have the breakfast menu, a brunch menu, a lunch menu, an afternoon tea menu, and then all night menu. And the waiters were actually waiters, not trying to be actors, which I think is fascinating when you go to certain restaurants like Musso and Frank's in Hollywood. It's actual waiters.
Or were they acting like they were actual waiters?
They could be, but they've been there for 30, 40 years.
Not very good actors.
They weren't good actors. They're still...
Well, you mentioned that the Pacific Dining Car was open 24/7. Another one that, not quite a pandemic casualty, they just had to reduce hours, but had been 24/7, was the original Pantry.
Yeah, former Mayor Richard Reardon's place.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think what's funny with that story, because they've moved twice or three times, and I have the actual addresses of where the freeway went through at one point, but somebody wrote from, I think, the Herald Examiner, the old newspaper from LA years back, they wrote that the people working there were former inmates. So when people would get out of jail, they'd go there thinking they could get a job, and they weren't former inmates.
So that wasn't true.
No, not at all. So even today, if you've been there, some people will say, so how long were you in jail? To the people working there, they're like, well, I've never been in jail. They never understood, but I was reading, I found that story.
How did that rumor get started?
It's just strange rumors that they'll just keep feeding, and people will believe it. You know, if you read it, that people believe it.
Well, it may have been famous wrongly for hiring ex-cons, but it was famous rightly for its pancake recipe.
Yeah, all their breakfast stuff is really good. They had a big dinner menu, too, but because of not 24 hours, they closed down about 2, 3 o'clock in the afternoon now, which is kind of sad.
Let's talk about El Cholo. This first opened in 1923. The location on Western opened in 31, still there today. Talk a little bit about how that kind of, I don't know, defined a little bit of the Southern California cuisine.
Well, they call them Spanish kitchen, Spanish food.
I noticed
food.
That. It's not Spanish food, though.
No, but they would say that because it was a kind of a bad, the Mexican food wasn't a good omen. You just didn't say you serve Mexican food. It was Spanish, even though it wasn't.
Tell us a little bit about the couple that opened it.
Well, they loved each other, and they're 7 generations back now. Ron is the one owning it now, and he's 90 years old. The place had been open 10 years when he was a kid, and he worked there from the beginning. And a lot of family members still work there. You go in, and you feel like you're in a museum. Everywhere you look on Western, there's got little... things framed and old menus framed. Even in the bathroom, they have menus framed. And the original name of it, they changed it to El Cholo, the name. After about 3 years, they had a different name. And a guy came in and made this little drawing of a little man, and he called him El Cholo. And the owners liked the name, and they thought, let's change the name of our place. So they had moved to Western, because they were downtown L.A. Okay. And now there is still a place in a different location, but their original location was downtown.
And it's inspired other restaurants that came after them.
Yeah, and there's some that are in the family that people don't realize they're family.
Such as?
El Coyote is part of the family.
Okay.
But they don't talk.
Oh.
Oh, no. Well. I don't know the fight. These family fights, I find a lot of interesting information out when I'm researching, and then they ask about the other person. They haven't talked to each other. So I just don't get into it.
Little birds between customers.
Yeah. They say, I hear El Cholo's going to be in the book, you know. So, and El Coyote, they're famous for the Sharon Tate's Last Meal.
And El Cholo had a famous clientele too, right? I mean, Jack Nicholson ate there. Ray Bradbury frequented. Nicholson even went to the funeral of a waitress at El Cholo. And now there's a bar named after her, Carmen's Cantina.
Yeah, she was a very exuberant woman that was fun. When you go to El Cholo, it's like the same waitress works the same section all the time, and you ask to be in their section because you're friends with her or him, but it's normally her. And you would feel like family. So Jack Nicholson would always go to her section and became friends and went to her funeral even.
Wow. You know, LA has such a broad mix of cultures too, ethnic traditions, styles, and one that stands out in your book too is a tiki, kind of Polynesian tropical fare. How did that come to influence Los Angeles restaurants?
I could do a whole book on tiki.
Please
really. Do. And there are some out there already, but tiki is, guys were coming back from the war in the 40s, and they had been to the South Pacific, and those regions, and that's where they learned how to make rum drinks, and they'd come back and start making them and opening up on the GI Bill little restaurants and things like that. So, you know, we still have a
yeah.
few of
and
them.
I guess it coincides, like you yeah. said, people coming back from the war. Los Angeles is becoming this booming town. Population is exploding.
Yeah.
You know, lots of the aerospace industries are out here. So you've got people kind of yeah. coming at the same time. And so you can see how that kind of feeds itself.
Right.
So, and there's also obviously a bunch of amazing Jewish delis here. Cantor's, Langer's, Nate and Al's in Beverly Hills. Do you have a favorite?
I could have added more. My favorite, well, Cantor's, I really like Cantor's, the whole family history. And that was an old theater back in the day where it is now. And they have a pickle room that I didn't even know about, that they make pickles and they make their own and they do the whole thing. And they go through a lot of pickles. You sit down, a tray of pickles and crunchies come to your table, almost like the tortilla chips and salsa in a Mexican restaurant.
Well, we talked about some pandemic casualties, but one success story is Tale of the Pup, which reopened last year. And that had a kind of fun, I guess, origin story in your book, right? They kind of zhuzhed up their original grand opening in the 50s by promising lots of celebrities eating hot yeah. dogs. Tell us that
yeah.
story.
Yeah, back when it opened in 46, 48, somewhere around in there, they had all these stars, people we never heard of. They were, you know, secondary stars.
Stars at the time.
Yeah.
yeah.
And they had a red carpet, and they had the floodlights going, and this little tiny hot dog, and that's all it was. So hot dogs were a big thing because they're less, they aren't that expensive. You just have to warm them up in water, pretty much, like Pink's. And it was easy food, and you could high profit margin. So there were a lot of hot dog places opened back then, and this is about the only one that survived.
So I wonder, like, having done this book and going through all these, you know, historic restaurants in Los Angeles, like, for the new places that are opening up, like, did you feel like you came away writing this with, like, this is sort of a recipe for success? This is what it takes to endure for, you know, decades, even a century in some of the cases of these restaurants. And what is that?
Number one thing that I found, mostly during the pandemic, own the property yourself. You have to buy the property because that's what closed a lot of places down. And Musso and Franks is in my first book that I did like this. And they had some hard times, but they didn't have to pay rent. So they did okay. And that's the place. El Cholo didn't have to pay rent. El Coyote, she owns the building. So it's things like that. They were able to survive, and the ones that weren't didn't. And I don't know about Pacific Dining Car. They should have owned the property, but I think it was time also for the family.
I mean, but I guess, like, major pandemic, global earth-shattering event aside, like, is there something else that, like, helps these places endure?
Probably the food's good, but it's the service. You get good service in these places. The uniqueness. California, we've got some unique things. I think if the Brown Derby came back, it would work.
Okay.
I really do.
Okay. Well, George, it's been so much fun having you in the studio.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Yes. George Geary's new book is called LA's Landmark Restaurants, Celebrating the Legendary Locations Where Angelenos Have Dined for Generations. Coming up, movie reviews. And this week, we've got a little something for everyone. A French thriller, a charming British rom-com, a powerful drama with a performance already generating awards buzz, and the action-packed Dungeons & Dragons. That's next on Press Play.